fun if it wasn't. But
The problem is these meetings are scribed.
No worries. That's all good. Let's go with the plan. So all good.
That's a shame. I'm sure I would have had more fun too. All right, great. Welcome everybody to today's CCG meeting. So today I'm delighted to have Andrew Trask join us from OpenMind. He works heavily in the privacy preserving machine learning area. So he's going to give us a bit of a deep dive into what they're doing. I think we can all agree, right? Like machine learning and identity, decentralized identity, the stuff we do here have a lot of synergy. And I think especially when you're talking about privacy preserving machine learning. So I hope this will be the start of some interesting discussions between our communities. Before we hand over to Andrew, just a couple of administrative things. So we do have a code of conduct, professional conduct. You know, treat people with respect, be nice, like listen and contribute. Let's have a productive conversation here today. Secondly, IP note. So anyone's welcome to participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributions to any CCG work items must be by members of the CCG with full IPR agreements signed. So as always, just reach out to any of the chairs if you have any problems with that or you're looking to join and you don't know how, we can help you. So call notes. This meeting is recorded and everything is archived and you know we can get you a link. Andrew, if you want one at the end of the call.
Right.
Okay, before we kick off, anyone want to introduce themselves or reintroduce themselves to the community today? Don't be shy.
Feel free to err on the side of introductions. I'd love to get to know you a bit.
Yep. People can be quite shy is the thing.
No worries.
Oh, Manu.
Yeah, I can just do one. I haven't done one in years. My name's Manu Sporni. I'm one of the lead editors and architects of a number of global standards around digital credentials, notably privacy preserving credentials. I've also worked with, some of your colleagues at OpenAI and a number of other kind of AI companies on this new proof of personhood.
Ah, yes.
Paper. Yeah, the personhood credentials paper. And we're trying to figure out a way of translating the needs in that paper to global standards here. So we kind of incubate those things in this group, and then we take it through the global standards track at the Internet Engineering Task Force or the World Wide Web Consortium. So I'm one of many people in this community that tries to make the web a better, more privacy-preserving thing for humanity, and so really appreciate the work that you're doing in that same vein. That's it.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks, Mario. Last chance. Anyone else? Okay. Moving on. Announcements, reminders. Anyone have any announcements or reminders for the community today? Mario.
Sorry, just a few. The W3C in-person technical plenary is coming up at the end of this month. So that's going to be several hundred of us in Anaheim, California. One of the breakout sessions is on, and I'll put a link to this in the chat channel, the future standards and innovations for W3C verifiable credentials. We are going to be covering a lot of stuff that's an incubation in this group. So render method, confidence method, unlinkable ECDSA, cryptography suites, verifiable credential barcodes, verifiable credential API, transmitting verifiable credentials over wireless, near field communication, peer-to-peer, and then a variety of vocabulary work. So that link takes you to the breakout session. I believe I don't know if this is true. I think the breakout sessions are open to the public and you can attend remotely. But I'm not positive about that. So just a heads up there. The other note is that, we are continuing to finalize the, global standards track stuff for verifiable credentials, data integrity in the verifiable credential working group. We are continuing to pick up implementers. I think we have 11 to 15 now, which is great. And just a call out, if you are working on an implementation for any of the global standards, please let us know so we can count you in the number of implementations. That's it from me.
Great. Thanks, Manu. Anyone else before I hand over to Andrew? Rest of the call? Seeing any, I will just say one thing, like on the work items, the CCG, I have, just before this call, was reviewing the GitHub repositories that we have in the CCG repo. And at some point in the near future, I would like to do a bit more of a thorough pass at that, maybe next call, ask for some help. But we have a lot, and it's hard to understand which ones are active, which ones are just stagnant, and which ones are paused. So it'd be good to try and tidy that up in the future. So if anyone has any suggestions for how we do that well, maybe you can reach out to me. I'd love to chat. Cool. With that, thanks. Andrew, over to you.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. I'm quite honored to be here. I really, I look up to W3C and have for, you know, a very long time and all the things that you guys represent and accomplish. Quite grateful to get to be here. Would it be okay if I shared my screen with that? Will the Jitsi and recording handle that okay?
Yes, absolutely. Should be fine.
Excellent. We'll try to do that. Cool. Can you see that?
Yes.
Brilliant. Still good?
Yep.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here. The work in online credentials in particular is fast paced these days, and extremely topical, you know, especially with other major topics in society like disinformation and basically the need for, you know, verified trails of information in a wide variety of contexts. What I'm going to try to describe for you is our vision for what is one step down for you in the downstream of verifiable credentials. So this is infrastructure for creating, training, evaluating AI systems and related data science systems that in my opinion, both can only be successful in the way that I would define success, kind of championing public goods and preserving privacy and all these types of things, if you are also successful. If that makes sense. So we are very much relying on you to define great standards that this whole ecosystem can then consume, if that makes sense. And so my great hope, with kind of giving this presentation is to try to just fill in some of the gaps of where the AI, kind of future of privacy preserving AI infrastructure is, and where it's headed, and to paint a little bit of a picture of it heading in the direction of more web-like technologies than has been in the past. So AI infrastructure in the past is very much like just big centralized clouds that you rent some machines occasionally. And it's very siloed and like siloed data, not particularly networked. There's not really verified attribution of basically anything. It's a bit of a free for all. Most of the serialization is insecure. Like it hasn't gotten to this point of maturity. And what I'm going to try to describe is downstream from what you're doing, hopefully going to consume what you're doing. And I hope that, painting this picture a little bit will help increase your awareness of what, you know, AI players might be interested in consuming, and could hopefully help your work. So that's my goal. I would say this is a fast-paced environment as well, and lots of things are changing. So would love the opportunity. If you find this information interesting, I would love to have the opportunity to come back and give you an update again in 6 months' time or something like that, because it really is changing quite quickly. Maybe before I jump in, so I know roughly how much time to spend on a couple different topics, because I don't want to waste your time. How familiar is the group with like secure MPC or differential privacy as paradigms? If I gave an introductory thing, would you be bored? I guess is my question.
I don't want to speak to the group, but I would say introduction is great. Yeah, mine's okay. Great too. One other thing, Andrew, it'd be great to leave like 10, 15 for questions, if you can.
Nope. problem. No problem. Cool. Yeah, we'd love to do that. So that sounds great. Cool. We'll hop right in. So the key problem that pets try to work on these days is that our ability to answer important questions, train important models, this kind of stuff is limited because access to existing data is difficult to obtain. So the question we're going to be asking today is, you know, is it possible to answer questions using data that's owned by someone else, data that you can't see? I'll go through a couple of use cases to give you a sense of the scenario that I'm describing. So here's one at the UN that we're familiar with. So the UN Statistics Division helps aggregate these types of statistics from various nations. Canada reports, you know, how much they think that they export to the United States. The United States reports how much they think they import from Canada among various categories. Most of the time, these things match. So this is like there are official government agencies that track the paperwork for what's supposed to be crossing borders between any two different countries. However, often they don't match, and they don't match like to huge variances. So like, for example, in February 2021, Canada thought they were exporting $3.5 million worth of straw to the United States. The United States has no record of it, has no idea where the straw went. You know, $300 million worth of aircraft just sort of flew off somewhere else. And, you know, around, $2.5 million worth of clocks that they don't know. That's probably a lot of like Rolexes and watches and stuff like that. And so on the flip side, the U.S. gets lots of things that it thinks are from Canada that Canada's like, I don't know, never seen this before, right? And this is a great example of like a data access problem at like the state level, where, you know, the United States can't access most of the world's data about its imports because it's stored in other countries. And inversely, Canada can't access most of the world's data about its exports because it's also stored in other countries. And so you have this whole global picture where all the world's nations, I mean, at the federal level, these are like at the stats agencies, the tax agency, this kind of stuff, they have a very myopic picture that they can see very accurately what's going on in their own country. But, you know, there's a kind of a black box once it leaves their country, because all the trade manifests and tax information, all this kind of stuff in, say, even amongst allies, doesn't get shared across borders for a wide variety of reasons. Some of them legal, some of them logistical, some of them financial, all sorts of reasons why that data doesn't get shared. And this is important because, you know, information about global trade drives all sorts of stuff, right? Economic surveillance, tax, sanctions and foreign policy, tariffs and taxes, you know, enforcement of customs, all sorts of stuff like relies on this. But we are actually supremely bad at it. Like there's long running discrepancies between the records of different countries that are very, very high variance, and so it's long standing problems. So, you know, one question is like, why can't we track this global trade together? Why can't like allies around the world decide to kind of put it all in one place? And it's basically just a bunch of big practical reasons why they can't put it all in one place. And so, you know, our ability to answer important questions about where the world's goods and services are going is limited because we can't access existing data. The data exists. It is representing where this stuff is going, but it's distributed across many different organizations in many different countries. Second use case, you're going to start to see a pattern here, breast cancer. So breast cancer is treatable when it's caught early, but hundreds of thousands of people still die from it every year. So as you may know, breast cancer affects around 1 in 8 women at some point in their life. Similar statistics for men for prostate cancer. There might be an improvement since this. I'll say that this particular project that I did looking this up is, you know, at least 18 months old. But the high level theme, as I talk to breast cancer experts on a regular basis, is not necessarily different. That mammograms have an accuracy issue, where especially in low income countries, where they can only hire one radiologist to look at them, there's a pretty high rate of false positive, false negatives in the process. And AI machine learning systems have not really improved the situation much. You can kind of get like an ensemble if you have a radiologist and an AI system, because their error rates can be in different classes. But there's not like there's no one who's going around saying AI machine learning has solved the problem or anywhere close to that, in my opinion. And this is like kind of a surprising thing, because at the end of the day, breast cancer classification is an image classification task that has an enormous amount of latent training data that's already annotated, because of breast cancer screening programs that have been happening around the world. However, no one is really able to train their breast cancer classifiers on more than like 0.1% of the world's data on this task. And so, you know, if you ask yourself, why doesn't the world have low cost, high accuracy breast cancer screening programs? A big part of it is that they have to hire expensive radiologists that require many years of training. And, the background, you know, the why AI and machine learning can't do it has more to do with just a data access problem. like AI machine learning is really, really good at image classification. And so I think it's not unreasonable to make the argument that like this is a solvable task using data and tools that already exist, but no one has access to enough of the data to work with it, right? So in that case, I would argue that breast cancer prediction or classification is not a tech problem. It's a partnership problem, right? So AI doesn't predict mammograms reliably because no one can create the 100 plus globally distributed data sharing partnerships needed to get a sufficiently large, diverse training data set. So same idea. Why can't AI perfectly predict breast cancer? Because we can't have these kind of global partnerships. Same idea in money laundering. So about $1.5 trillion in criminal proceeds are laundered annually. You know, this is the same type of shell game that I showed a second ago in the context of global trade. So, you know, a bank like Citi can't access most of the world's data about where its money comes from because it's stored in other banks, right? So basically the way that you launder money is you have a small business somewhere, or collection of small businesses, and then you kind of shuffle things around so that by the time it all lands in Citi or some major bank, they don't have enough international partnership, data sharing partnerships to know where that originally came from. So the same template, and there's lots of interesting, early work in privacy and technologies, across the various governments, looking into this, including, an executive, or I guess a statement from the White House, not too long ago. Finally, AI auditing, similar idea, right? So again, there's a wide variety of organizations around the world, that have AI systems or that record data about impacts of AI systems in the world. So, For example, one of the things I like to ask is, you know, if you think about someone using a popular AI model or AI system, whether it's a recommender engine for a social media company or a large language model or something like this, and you might say, oh, well, surely the company itself has, you know, access to user logs that would tell us whether the algorithm is good or bad. But that's true right up until the point you try to measure whether people are actually getting hurt. If that makes sense. You can look at the AI model outputs and kind of speculate on whether they're getting hurt or something like that. But truthfully, if you wanted to know whether, say, an update to a recommender algorithm for a social media company causes, you know, mental health issues, causes eating disorders, or increases the rate of depression or, you know, teen self-harm or something like that, that data about, you know, teen self-harm or, you know, suicides or any sort of stuff, that's at medical centers, right? Whereas the data about an AI system and when people were using it is in the user log of a company. And so you have this same partnership problem. You have this same, like, part of the data about, like, which AI systems are getting used and updated and who is using them is in a bunch of databases at some companies. And then who is having mental health or physical health or other types of issues is at other companies, right? And so there's this kind of big, important data join issue, that multiple organizations around the world, for a wide variety of reasons, competitive, legal, comms, PR, you know, regulatory, logistical, financial reasons, can't pool all their data into one giant database to answer all of life's biggest questions. And, so as a result, our ability to answer important questions is limited because we can't access existing data. Like, the ability to answer these things is not, you know, it's not that our algorithms aren't super intelligent enough. It's not that, you know, the data doesn't exist. It's just a data access problem, if that makes sense. And I could continue with more of these things. There's a wide variety of use cases that where some part of the problem can be framed as like this data access type issue, where we could solve X important challenge using existing data, but no one can access any data but their own, right? And the argument that we make at OpenMind is that that's because the way that you do data science requires pooling all this data into one massive database to do your project, right? If you're working for a university and you're doing a project, you get a copy of all the data that you need, and then you do your project, something like that, right? And our pitch is that instead, this is going to be a big federated data network, right? And that it's similar to the vision of personal data pods, but not necessarily that. I think that, like, personal data pods could be one version of this. But this is more pointing at, like, there is a very, very significant amount of latent demand that is not being met. And we believe that the shortest path to meeting that demand, that market demand, political demand, is through a big federated data network and a new type of infrastructure, for kind of doing data science, on non-public information. So, how is the community broadly solving it, right? And the community broadly solving it through a phrase of things called privacy-enhancing technologies, which you guys are already familiar with, many of them, I'm sure. I describe privacy-enhancing technologies as like a high-level umbrella term for many independent fields. And I think that's important because it characterizes the nature of the challenge, right? There are a wide variety of different pets that actually do very similar things, but can do very similar things, if that makes sense. So I would put a lot of the stuff in decentralized identity, for example, as like input verification issues, where we want to have people be able to sign inputs to information flows that are important in society. Input privacy technologies, you know, there's a variety of substitute technologies, whether it's secure enclaves or homomorphic encryption or secure multi-party computation. These things are doing similar things in the sense that they're facilitating a group of people to use data together while keeping their inputs secret, right? And then there's kind of these two other groups as well, some of which you'll be already familiar with. These four categories come from a paper called Structured Transparency that tries to cluster privacy-enhanced technologies into groups that have shared outcomes or shared applications, if that makes sense. But to return to the question of this talk, you know, how do we answer questions using data owned by someone else? The thing that I would argue is that, like, this high level, you know, for the purpose of this talk and this use case in the AI community, this high level question is what matters, and that privacy enhanced technologies are all the ingredients and algorithms that we would look to use together in order to be able to accomplish this high level goal. If that makes sense. So by analogy, there's lots of people in the privacy-enhanced technology community space that are working on individual car parts, you know, better homomorphic encryption, better federated learning, better, you know, secure enclaves, this kind of stuff. But we don't yet have a car. We don't yet have this thing that you can just get in and start using, right, to study data owned by someone else. And what I'd like to try and describe for you today is sort of what I think this car is going to look like. And part of the reason I want to describe this to you is that I think that you're going to find it web-like. And it's actually coming towards you and towards the paradigms that you are experts in, and that are going to make it increasingly relevant as an application area. I hope will make it increasingly relevant as an application area and a place where your work will have lots of impact, and potentially early impact, which is kind of exciting. So here's my case for what the car of pets would be. So the case I would make is that it's very similar to the Apache web server, but for private information as opposed to for public information, where, you know, if the way the internet works today is based on a primitive where there's a bunch of servers all around the internet, they all hold files, and you click a link, and your browser downloads those files into the browser, and your browser knows how to show them to you. And that's like the basic, you know, the basic principle upon which a lot of web technologies are built. This is a slightly different type of web server. It's still a server holding a bunch of files, right? But instead of downloading a copy of those files, it's a bunch of infrastructure to try to make it so that you can download the answer to a question based on those files without actually downloading the files. If that makes sense. And roughly speaking, there's a data owner who has a server. They load their private data into a server. They create accounts for potential users of that server, and then they leave and they go have a coffee, right? And then, you know, a data scientist or someone who's trying to use this non-public information shows up, logs in, you know, using their credentials, remotely generates answers to an allowed set of questions. Meaning, and this is the pets part, right? Where a data scientist can come in and the data owner has configured the server in such a way where an external person, where they've already pre-specified what classes of question they think are okay, if that makes sense. And that's what allows the server to bring some automation and some scale to the process, right? So that, you know, a data scientist can create answers to allowed sets of questions, and hopefully download those results in a highly automatic fashion, you know, without lots and lots of back and forth. So the vision here for what privacy-enhanced technologies together can facilitate is something that skips a lot of the heavy, painful process of working with non-public data today. So, you know, no bespoke data partnerships, no meetings with lawyers, no getting on the phone, no background checks, no other delays. That the idea is that answering questions using another organization's server could be as easy as going to that organization's public website, right? That's the scale vision that hopefully, aspirationally, these types of privacy-enhanced technologies could come together to be able to facilitate end-to-end. So now, with that perspective, if each individual server is the car of PETS, what are the roads? Well, I think this naturally implies a network, right? It naturally implies some type of network services that help lots of organizations kind of collectively use and collectively govern and collectively, you know, facilitate access to data of different types. So we obviously need some network services for search and discovery, for delegated permissions. This is highly related to like legal consortia. So if, for example, I want to access data at 1,000 hospitals, I have a problem. And that problem is, even if they all say yes, those hospitals will have a bureaucratic process where I will have to make 1,000 IRB board presentations, right? And that's just like logistically painful for everyone involved, even though the IRB board presentation process is supposed to be standardized, right? So in theory, they can respect each other's IRBs, but that's not how the infrastructure is necessarily set up. And that's what kind of legal consortia or data consortia actually exist to do at the legal level, right? So you can imagine that we need legal consortia that can map onto the kind of network style services to try to help make that scale. So that officially, if, you know, any one of these hospitals runs the IRB board, that respects it, that a bunch of our main servers would be interested in rolling along with that. And you can imagine that links very closely with how this type of infrastructure might be interested in consuming various types of digital identity schemes and signatures and all this kind of stuff to know who's approved which types of data access projects. So cartoon version of this, you know, data scientists, you know, it leverages a network, get some type of data access or consortia approval, if a consortia approval is needed. That gets forwarded down to lots of independent servers. For the ones that approve that at the server level, which can be automatic or manual approval, then the kind of privacy and technologies come in to facilitate that access. And the grand vision is that, like, ultimately this will become, you know, network-like and relatively decentralized and relatively federated, but with some checks and balances over, within these kind of data consortia that could exist, that could pop up in different places. So instead of a data scientist, when they want to do a project, needing to obtain a copy of all this data into one place, they could sit at the center of a big federated data network and just propose questions that use data from many places and download the results. Right. So, how are we making concrete progress towards this vision? So let's take a closer look at the technologies, and I'll give you a bit of an overview. So I'm talking about a platform called PySift. This is freely available, open source, Apache 2 licensed, you know, all this kind of stuff. That make it open infrastructure. OpenMind is a nonprofit, so we're funded by donors to help make this kind of freely available open source infrastructure. I'll walk through a couple paradigms that are in it. This is by no means a complete walkthrough, but it'll give you a sense of the types of things we're working on, and then hopefully that will be fruit for interesting conversation. So first, and this is the heavy hitter, basic remote execution, right? They have a computer, they have data in it, and I am going to do something on their computer despite having limited access to that computer, right? To give you one example of a remote execution paradigm that we've done, there is a version of PySift that we've done that uses what we call eager execution, so highly interactive remote execution. The first primitive that I should introduce to you is a variable called a worker. So this gives me a variable that points to someone else's computer, and with that I can use that to try to call APIs that are against that computer. So this is all in Python. There's no reason this has to be in Python, but I'm showing you a Python interface. So let's say PyTorch is a really popular deep learning framework. So let's say I have a list of numbers, 1, 3, 4, 5. I want to send that into the hospital data center. So, you know, it serializes and sends over to another computer. And what I get back is a pointer. So this is a standard RPC style tool. That pointer can have an exact replica of the actual pointer that's sitting inside that data center over there, so that when I do things locally, you know, it feels like I'm doing local computation, even though I'm doing remote computation. And so with that by itself, I can do quite a lot of relatively sophisticated coordination of
we all got kicked.
Yeah.
Was that just me? No,
okay. No, a bunch of us got kicked off.
I was getting pretty juicy.
Yeah.
I was really listening.
Where are you back? Oh, yeah. You're looking through your screen.
Where should I go back to?
Yeah, this bit. for your remote execution. I think we got to like Y plus X plus X.
Okay, great. So this is like a highly interactive way to coordinate execution on another computer. This is not the only way to do things, and we can talk about other paradigms that people use. You know, some look like a little more like a mailbox for code kind of thing, where you can send methods or classes or this kind of stuff. But this is a nice intuitive way to get started. The most difficult part of this interface, by far, is that last method down at the bottom, .get. Because .get is what you actually get to learn back. Everything before that is what we might call a streaming API. It's all me sending information in, and I'm able to speculate on what pointers must exist over there, if that makes sense. But every time I call .get to get an intermediate result or all these types of things, I am potentially exposing their non-public information. And we're gonna talk about you know, all the mechanics that go into trying to make .get secure in a moment. And that's like side channel, you know, the information it sends you, the side channels, all sorts of stuff. Try to make that easy too. So second tool I want to walk you through is called search and example data. So we're starting with the real basics here, and this is just kind of the bare bones of how this happens in practice, right? So for this, let's say I have I'm linked to a network that's got a variety of different servers on it. You know, I can search for data sets of a certain type. So, you know, maybe I found some diabetes data. I get a pointer to a diabetes data set. This is the same as the X pointer that I was showing you a moment ago. And, you know, I get some basic descriptions of what's in this data set, you know, and I can see some sample data. And what this allows me to do, this kind of mock or fake data, here allows me to know, okay, there's some hidden asset that's over there, and I can download myself a fake or pretend version of that asset, and that greatly informs my ability to write code against it. I'm going to talk about some fancy algorithms in a minute, but I'll tell you, this is the heavy hitter. Like people, like you can get really, really, really far if you have really good example assets. So if the thing on the other side, inside the hidden server, is a CSV file or a pandas data frame or a PyTorch tensor or a Hugging Face model or whatever it might be, if you take the real version of it and kind of scramble all the values inside of it, randomize them, right? And very, very often the data owner is comfortable sending that to the data scientist for them to then write code against, but they can then write relatively sophisticated code that is very coherent because they basically have a local copy, even though they don't, right? So they can see everything except for the final answers they're looking for. So, this ends up being hugely helpful in practice. Tool number three, differential privacy. I'm doing kind of a whirlwind tour here. The differential privacy, some of you might be familiar. The purpose of differential privacy is to ensure that statistical analysis doesn't compromise privacy. So we're talking about the results here. So when I get, you know, when I query a database or when I send in code to a data site and I get my results, right? The intuitive definition of perfect privacy from a differential privacy perspective is that the output of my query, the result that I get back from them, is the same for the query that I did and the query with one person in the database removed or replaced. So if I'm training a machine learning model on medical records, right, and I remove someone's medical record and my result doesn't change, then we would say that that person is not leaking any information through the results. So in this case of this database that I've got here on the left, so if you have Bob, Bill, Sue, John, Joe, Pat, Amy, and Alice, if I query this database, let's say the ones and zeros are trues and false, this kind of thing. If I query it and I get the number 7, and I query it again, but with John's data removed, and I still get the number 7, right, then differential privacy intuitively would say, well, that means that John's data is not a part of the number 7. Like the number 7 is not affected by John in any way, and so John's privacy is perfectly protected. Now, you might say, well, Andrew, how many functions actually do that? That's ridiculous. Like, if you limited it, you know, clearly you're learning nonsense if the individual people in the data, don't change its value. So what differential privacy does in practice is it creates what it calls a sensitivity metric. And that sensitivity metric tries to bound the degree to which the output of the function changes as a result of some person in the database being removed or replaced, if that makes sense. And based on that kind of foothold, it's able to propose various ways to measure and manage that risk, if that makes sense. So the you can measure what's the maximum degree to which you might be leaking information about one person, as opposed to just aggregate statistics about the group. And you know, what mechanisms can you provide to do something about that? So let me give you an example of the most, this is the typical canonical hello world mechanism for protecting privacy in this context. It's called randomized response. So let's imagine for a moment that I was going to survey all of you about whether you had committed a crime recently and gotten away with it, right? We won't even specify what crime it is. We'll just say, I'm going to sit each one of you down. I'm going to ask you, hey, have you committed a crime recently? And you will answer true or false. However, committing a crime sometimes comes with punishment, which would be bad. So I might have a problem as someone who's trying to conduct an accurate survey of this phenomenon of, what percentage of people within the W3C meeting group on Tuesday afternoons happen to also be criminals, right? You might be likely to deceive and not answer. Yeah, exactly. And not answer honestly. And so I'm like, oh man, but I'm a scientist. I just want to know about the phenomena. I'm not a member of law enforcement. I just want an accurate picture. So how can I persuade you to give me an accurate picture at the high level for the whole group while each of you maintains your anonymity and maintains your protection? So here's what I do with this one technique. There's many techniques for doing this. Here's one technique. This is called randomized response. So I might sit down with each one of you. And I would hand you a coin, and I would ask you to flip that coin twice somewhere that I can't see, right? So you turn around, you flip this coin twice, and then I would ask you, I'd say, okay, I want you to answer, did you commit a crime? And if the first coin flip was a heads, I want you to answer honestly, right? So if the first coin flip was a heads, I want you to answer honestly. But if the first coin flip was a tails, I want you to answer true or false according to the second coin flip, right? So roughly half of you will answer honestly, and roughly half of you would answer according to a 50-50 coin flip. So let's talk about the privacy aspect of this. What this means is that even if you tell me, yes, I did commit a crime, and I feel very bad, I'll have to think to myself, wait, they might be saying yes because they actually committed a crime. Or they might be saying yes because of the way that the coins worked out. Right? So that means each person ends up getting plausible deniability. And that the degree to which you get plausible deniability is based on the bias of the coin flip. Right? So if the first coin flip was very, very, very likely to be heads, then I know it's very, very likely you're being honest, right? If that makes sense. But if the first coin flip was very, very likely to be tails, then I know that it's very, very likely that, that you were dishonest in this very structured way. So now, in theory, everyone has some degree of protection based on that first coin flip. But let's zoom out for a moment and say, okay, but was I still able to get the statistic that I was interested in, which is, how many people were criminals on average? And the nice thing about this is that what this process does is it averages the true statistic with a 50-50 coin flip. And I can reverse the effect of that average, right? So let's say, for the sake of argument, that like 60% of you were criminals, secret underlords of the underworld, doing crazy stuff. And I did this survey and everyone participated. Then the result of my survey would be 55%, right? When I actually counted the coins that I got, I would get 55% would say, yes, 55% are criminals. But what I would know is that that 55% has already been averaged with a 50-50 coin flip, right? So if all of you tell me 55%, then what I actually know to be true, what I would believe to be true, is that 60% of people are actually criminals, if that makes sense. And so this double property, this like, you get individual protection and I get a useful statistical result, is the essence of differential privacy and why there's an interesting differential privacy mechanism. So if we go back to this scenario for a second, right? I can query the database of you all and I can generate a statistical result, but it's very difficult for me to use the statistical result to reverse engineer information about you guys. Meaning if I, and the main context that this happens in is like if I were to query the database many times. So like if I were to survey you and then survey you again and survey you again, or like survey you with five people missing and see if the statistic changed and all this kind of stuff, right? That the repeated analysis over time of this database would still have a certain degree of protection that we would not cross, if that makes sense. Now, how does it actually make its way into data science interfaces, right? So I've given you like a hypothetical thing involving flipping coins and, you know, personal surveys and all this stuff, right? And that's like not exactly, you know, when you're trying to process millions of rows of data, you know, it's not exactly necessarily how you would approach the problem, right? So the actual interface of the problem was this pointer, if you remember us. We had this pointer into this place that's somewhere else, and we had this function called .get where, you know, I'm downloading the result of my computation. So, I did some type of computation over there, and I'm trying to download it. And the instead of being able to download everything I have a pointer to, what I actually get is an error like this. It says, whoa, you just tried to request a data point, which is private, or which depends on data, which is private. You can only query private data if noise is added, right? And by noise added, I mean some sort of 50-50 coin flip-like apparatus that is adding noise to the data or to the process so that individual people get this plausible deniability to some degree, if that makes sense. And in differential privacy literature, the way to calibrate that noise is through a parameter called epsilon. And so what we hope for our data science interfaces is the ability to like sort of automatically just put in the epsilon that you want, and then you get your results automatically. Now that might call into question, what is epsilon? Epsilon is a kind of ubiquitous tool within differential privacy literature that tries to bound the probability that it's actually not bound the probability, it's bound the increase in probability that you will be re-identified with this result, if that makes sense. So let's say that Will Abramson is on this call, right? Let's say that Will Abramson was a criminal. And he's trying to hide that from me, right? Sorry, Will. Didn't mean to call you out, but you're the only person here that I know. I'm picking on you. And there was, because of data that already existed in the world, there was a 5% chance that Will was going to get found out, if that makes sense. That's what I believe, right? So there is a way to configure epsilon where I could say, okay, after this query, the worst that I would do is double whatever his existing probability is, if that makes sense. So the worst that this query would do was cause Will's chance of getting found out to go from 5% to 10%, right? And that's the way the epsilon mechanism works. It's like a cap on the multiplication of probability that someone's going to be re-identified. And there's a bunch of ways in which that can be done efficiently or inefficiently, and how much of the world can you model within the differential privacy mechanism. There's a bunch of interesting literature that goes way down that rabbit hole, right? We don't have time to go into that today. But that's the essence of what it's about. I want to leave 10, 15 minutes. I'm going to go pretty quickly through this last thing. Secure multi-party computation. It's really cool. This is a form of input privacy. Multiple people can share ownership over a number. This is really close to cryptography, so I'm guessing quite a few more of you know about secure MPC already. Here's the cartoon version that I will show. This is not the full version or even a robust algorithm, but you'll get the sense. Let's say I have a number 5. I can split it into 2 shares, a 2 and a 3. Normally, these would be hugely randomized numbers that are modulo a large prime, but like for the sake of argument, let's say for random chance, I happen to draw these 2 random numbers. I split this into 2 shares. I have 2 friends. I give the shares to these 2 friends. I disappear. Now, what's the thing? Marianne doesn't know what number is encrypted between Marianne and Bobby, right? Why? Because she can't see the other share. The other share could be negative infinity 2,000 billion, whatever, or it could be positive 250,000 billion, whatever. And Marianne has no information about what the other shares might be, if that makes sense. And so as a result, you know, this number is encrypted in a sense. Like it's encrypted between these 2 different shareholders. And you can also think of these shares as private keys if that's helpful. The second thing is they get shared governance. You can only do something with this 5 if all the shareholders agree, and that's kind of nice. But the miraculous thing with secure MPC is that you can do computation while numbers are in this shared state, and the results end up having the same governance paradigm as the inputs, unless you do more fancy things. But in this case, we're doing the simple thing. So in this case, they were able to multiply. You know, there's a linearity to this particular protocol where each of them, if they wanted to multiply their 5 times 2, they can multiply their share times 2, and now you get a new encrypted 10. And that's kind of nice. Okay. For the purpose of AI machine learning, models and data sets are just large collections of numbers that we can individually encrypt, right? So you can imagine, and then I can basically give you a walkthrough here of a Python script, and I'm going to gloss through this so we have time for questions, where I search for data sets across the internet, here a handful of different servers, so I see Canada and the United States. I can select and log in to those two servers. Then those two servers give me a privacy budget. So this is like how much epsilon I have to spend, if that makes sense. So I have 200 epsilon here. 200 epsilon is like a ton. It's like a really lot. I can get a pointer to those individual data sets. In this case, this is the trade data, that I mentioned from the first use case. And here's the crucial part. And then we'll end and we'll have 10 minutes for questions. This should be impossible. And here's why this should be impossible. I went through really quickly, so it's not obvious, but the variable on the left is in a computer in the United States, right? It's literally in one country. I'm pointing to a computer in one country. The variable on the right, I'm pointing to a computer in a different country, right? So subtracting them should be impossible because they're not on the same computer, if that makes sense. But what happens behind the scenes is SecureMPC kicks in and it splits both numbers into sets of shares and trades them between these two servers so that now the result, the diff, it has been computed, but its shares are held by these two different parties, if that makes sense. So the diff is now is encrypted across USA and Canada and their two different servers. And if I wanted to download it, right, I would pass it in with a certain amount of noise, and this would spend privacy budget and let me see the result, if that makes sense. This is not the only interface to do this. This is not even necessarily the best way to do this in all cases. What I'm doing is just giving you an example of how privacy-enhanced technologies can combine to give someone the ability to pretend like they have all the data in the world put in one place, even though they don't, if that makes sense, even though it's being independently governed by a handful of servers around the world. The natural question that this situation arises and why identity is going to become hugely important first the basic identity of everyone in the system. That's obvious. Who is the data scientist? Who are the data owners? Do they trust each other? How much privacy budget should they be giving to each other? All this kind of stuff is grounded on that, those identity properties. But secondarily, this data that I was just working with, I now don't actually see it. And when you don't see the raw input data, it calls into question if it's real or not. And this is where having other people who have seen the data that signed it in some way with some properties in these kind of privacy preserving ways, you know, zero knowledge proofs and this type of stuff ends up being really, really important, right? And the notion of like, you know, if you have a personal data pod that has your Netflix data in or something like that, and I'm going to do some movie recommender AI on it, I have no idea if you corrupted your own data, right? Unless Netflix or someone else has signed it and I have the ability to check against their public key and all this kind of stuff. So all the conclusion that I really want to paint for this is that the whole vision of privacy preserving AI and unlocking access to data across, you know, every, you know, 1,000 times more data in every scientific field and discipline. Because we can leverage the world's, you know, cancer data together or the world's trade data together, all this type of stuff, is utterly dependent on the mission that you guys are working on being successful. If you can't accomplish it, then this whole apparatus continues to be blinded, right, by information that it can't see and then can't verify, if that makes sense. So I'm deeply grateful for all the work that you guys are doing, and I really just wanted to make the case that of how important it is for you guys to solve the problem and give a little bit of a description as best I can of the way in which the AI machine learning community might consume it. So with that, we can go to questions. And thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Andrew. That was awesome. Okay, who's up? Harrison?
Yes. Well, Andrew, thank you for a great, great presentation. I really enjoy it. Now, in the last example you gave, is it mm-hmm. a whole more morphic encryption where you just like encrypt data and do calculations on it? And if it's not, how is homomorphic encryption calculations different from multi-party computation?
So in the textbook, They would secure multi-party computation is a class of algorithm, and homomorphic encryption is in that class, if that makes sense. So homomorphic encryption is a type of secure multi-party computation. Sometimes people kind of gloss over that because homomorphic encryption tends to be single key, and like it's hard. Sometimes it's hard to do multi-party computation with homomorphic. You have to do it in very standardized ways, very specific ways. So often people refer to HE directly, but there's like four or five different clusters of algorithm that all do this. So that all do secure multi-party computation in one way or another. So secure enclaves, like secure hardware, like GPU enclaves or Intel SGX or crap. What's the main one that was the first one that was really early? Sorry, it's slipping my mind. So it's like hardware options. There's I guess offline encryption options like homomorphic encryption. The one that I showed you here is actually called additive secret sharing. And the reason I showed it is because it's the simplest one, which would be like an online version of secure multi-party computation, or highly interactive is another way that people would describe it. So in practice, people, the most mature version of the infrastructure will use all of them at the same time. It'll be the fastest secure multi-party computation, the fastest secure MPC things We'll use a little bit of homomorphic encryption here, a little bit of zero knowledge proof there, a little bit of additive secret sharing here and there, and potentially also some secure hardware. Like they fuse into each other in different contexts. They have different performance trade-offs, if that makes sense. And so trying to optimize those performance trade-offs, whether it's RAM or compute overhead or network overhead or these types of things, usually ends up involving a mixture of them.
Got it. Sorry, a quick follow-up question. Like earlier, so you mentioned about performance trade-offs, like what is the, practical applications, because like we actually tried it like 4 years ago on the homomorphic, encryption. Mm-hmm. It was like really, really slow. So basically, practically speaking, it's not very usable. So like how has that advanced like, in the recent times in terms of performance?
So secure enclaves are the ones that have leapt way out in front. So 4 or 5 years ago, secure enclaves had problems where they just didn't have very much RAM. So they were hard to use in practice. That has been like long solved. And now we're in the stages of being relatively close to having GPU, secure enclaves. So, there's a partnership between, NVIDIA and Azure, and then another team at Google, as well. And, Apple just released, that wasn't GPU, that was CPU. Secure enclaves are well on their way. GPU enclaves have, I think it's single-digit performance overhead. So, like, if it took 100 minutes, now it will take 110 minutes to run some job. And the main compute overhead there is just encrypting and decrypting when it goes from the chip to the RAM. Because it basically, the hard part is the RAM is fully encrypted. That's, like, the thing. Using a key that only the chip has. So, in theory, no one can see the computation. And so the main performance bottleneck, as I understand it, is the act of encrypting and decrypting in the trips between the chip and RAM, and that ends up being like 10% in practice.
Got it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Homework encryption is still pretty slow. Secure MPC is like, I think, 100x slower than plain text CPU for like deep learning jobs. So huge hits there, but the GPU enclaves are like a, once they're fully done, they're still finishing the drivers and dealing with some side channel attacks, as I understand it. But once they're kind of fully baked, people seem pretty optimistic about them.
Thanks, Andrew. That was fantastic. Great presentation. Thank you. One of the things I'm wondering is about what can we be working on that's going to help your initiatives. I think what's missing right now is kind of the glue that binds our community together with the, kind of the AI community. So, we've got tools and we are actively working on zero knowledge proof, mechanisms, advanced ones beyond just like, BBS and things like that. So cryptographic circuits and, ZKVMs and SNARKs and STARKs and, all that kind of stuff. But we largely think in kind of, single credentials, like a driver's license or a passport or a health checkup, right? I mean, you can have, education certificates, that kind of thing that are held in people's, private data stores or digital wallets.
Yep.
And everything's digitally signed by issuers. So this is, as you have said, high value, trusted data that is sitting with an individual. And we have ways of, doing a zero knowledge proof on that information that we're holding and then presenting it to, in general, to the public or to a specific thing. But I think the thing that's missing is we don't understand, what other things we should be working on that would be high value to your community. Right. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, what are the, you know, we've got a set of technologies and we could run down them and say, this is what they do. And here's how we think it can help you. But we don't have someone from your side going, yeah, but what we really need is X.
Got it.
Right.
So, I let me feel around in the dark a little bit there. I think that I know, but also, yeah, this is probably interactive a little bit, probably requires some interaction. My guess is that the shortest path is if there was some aspect of the like HTTPS standard that made it or similar standards that made it so that it was much, much easier for someone who downloads data that is signed by some data hosting organization to then make that portable. That would be game changer overnight. And there's like some projects working on this. I forgot that there's one that's funded by Ethereum Foundation. I can't remember that has some like interactive proofs that create some interactive zero knowledge proofs that then become portable, but it's still really difficult. They're having to absolutely bend over backwards to try to get it, like HTTPS to do it. Mm-hmm. And so if there was anything that you could do that was upstream, basically the challenge is not like, does the cryptography technically exist to, that great question, Wendy. And that's why I'm just perfect timing on that question. There's two problems. One is like the technology of like technically signing something and saying, this is true, all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. That like cryptography stuff all exists. Like I'm not worried about that. The hard part is like, how do you get all the world's organizations to just inherit it by default, right? Mm-hmm. We're like, all of a sudden, when I download my Netflix history from Netflix, it's just trivial for me to also pull down a zero knowledge proof automatically. And like all these like laws like GDPR and this kind of stuff that make data downloading easy. Like if I'm doing it from a website, it means I'm getting I'm getting the ability to have a verifiable credential of everything that I'm downloading from them and just piggybacking on, cause like most of the world's data is held by organizations that have a website and some type of portal that I log in using a password. And so that would be just game changer. So that basically all these organizations participating, all they would have to do to participate is launch a website. And maybe if they wanted to be nice, expose the data through a JSON endpoint. Mm-hmm. They have staff and know how to do that. They do not have staff that knows how to and feels comfortable managing a complex zero knowledge proof system. Mm-hmm. So I think very, very practically, that's the tipping point at which like we would go from zero organizations participating to like millions of organizations participating like overnight. That's what comes to mind.
Okay, that's very helpful. And how do we keep in touch with you? That's I think the key thing is that this needs to be an ongoing conversation. So we need to figure out how we keep the conversation going beyond this meeting.
Oh, brilliant. So Will is always a great point of contact. We have an open Slack, so feel free to reach out. So, I guess I should have plugged that. Slack.openmind.org. If I can switch, there's like you pull this, if you go to slack.openmind.org, it will give you a little thing. I think I can put in the chat. We're at time.
Got it. Thanks.
There's our website has also some stuff that we do, as well. So, and there's like, I guess at the bottom is the main like activities that we've done, as well. Let's stay in touch.
Cool. Thanks, Andrew. Yeah, I mean, I put myself on the queue to ask you to shout out the Open Mind community, but I guess that will do. We are over time, so I think we probably can close there. But thanks for coming on, Andrew. I always enjoy hearing about what you're working on.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, and please, you know, keep doing the great work, because we need all the world data to have, like, signatures from real people that are privacy-preserving for this whole thing to work. So, keep doing what you do.
Great. All right, have a great week, everyone. See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye. See you, Andrew. Bye.